Today's guest is Dr. Richard Moskowitz, who has a BA from Harvard, an MD from New York University, and a graduate fellowship in philosophy at the University of Colorado. He's practiced general family medicine since 1967, and he has practiced homeopathic medicine since 1974, studying with George Withulkas, Rajan Sankaran, and others. In addition to lecturing and teaching, he has authored several books, including Homeopathic Medicines for Pregnancy and Childbirth, and Resonance, the Homeopathic Point of View. His other writings include Plain Doctoring, as well as An Introduction to Homeopathy, and The Case Against Immunizations, as well as The Fundamentalist Controversy, which you can be downloaded as a MS Word document. There's also Vaccination, A Sacrament of Modern Medicine, Childhood Ear Infections, and Why I Became a Homeopath. I'm sure you will absolutely enjoy this episode just as much as I have interviewing this amazing man. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the Homeopathy Hangout, where we discuss all things homeopathy from around the world. And now my mum and your host, Eugenie Kruger.
Hello, homies, and a very warm welcome to Homeopathy Hangout. Today, I am so excited that we have the wonderful, the legendary, the one and only Richard Moskowitz on the show. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh my gosh, it's such an honor to have you on here. You have been such an inspiration for so many decades to so many of us. So it's just beautiful to have you on here. I know you've had, what's it, 5 decades of experience now. I think you're officially our most experienced homeopath. We've had many with 4 decades. I don't think we've had anyone with 5 decades. Maybe Jill Turland, who turned 80 end of last year. Well, and she's still practicing.
I've been practicing medicine for 53 years.
Oh my goodness.
But only homeopathy for only 46.
Oh my gosh, that's not good enough. Only 46. Richard, can you even still remember how you were first introduced to homeopathy? I always ask my guests this question. How were you first introduced?
I do. It was a big event in my life. I remember it quite well. I'll just start with that. I'll just say I was very dissatisfied with medicine. When I finished medical school, I dropped out for a while. I went to graduate school and I studied philosophy. I had a fellowship in philosophy, and I really didn't think I would ever see a patient again. And one thing led to another. And the main thing that happened was I lost my student deferment from the draft. It was in the Vietnam War. And I eventually got a 1Y classification, which was the most coveted of those years. It meant physically, mentally, or morally unfit for service, except in the time of a national emergency. And I thought that had me pegged pretty well, especially the morally part. So I decided it was time for me to intern and start earning an honest living for a change. And so I still had a lot of trouble with medicine in the sense that I think it was really the war in a way that really crystallized it for me, because I realized that the language, the metaphors of medicine are military. It's antibiotics and antihypertensives and anti this and anti that. And we fight diseases and we develop weapons to fight them. And the more potent they are, the better. We want to kill the disease. We want to destroy it. And I just didn't like the way that felt. And so I was just all over the place with that. And I had already evolved to the point where once I finished my internship and I went into practice, I was practicing what I would call minimalist medicine, which was I didn't mind giving drugs for acute sicknesses, for infections and antibiotics and things like that. But I didn't like the idea of giving people drugs for life or for long periods for chronic illness all the time, every day. That just didn't feel right to me. I couldn't exactly say why, but it felt like war to me. I just didn't like the way it felt. But at the same time, so I felt that my role was guiding people through the medical maze and see that they didn't get hurt too badly. But the trouble is, when their illnesses got worse, when they really needed a lot of help, I didn't have anything affirmative to offer them. I was really pretty low at that point. And at that point, something happened which really changed my life. And that was that some woman I had just met was having a baby, and she asked me if I would come to her house and help her with the birth. And I thought, what kind of a crazy idea is that? But I was talking to her, and none of the obstetricians would touch it with a 10-foot pole. And as I talked to her, I realized she was giving me a present. She was showing me a way that I could practice medicine where I wasn't telling her what to do or how to live or forcing her body into compliance with what I thought it should be doing. I was just helping her do what she was already doing. What she was already trying to do. And so I went to her house, and I immediately wanted to do a vaginal exam right away because that's the way I was trained. And everybody, and the Bach was playing there, and everybody was sitting there paying attention. And I realized this is just a routine procedure. She's not asking me for this. She probably doesn't need me to do this. So the best thing I can do is just sit down and pay attention like everybody else. And so I did. And of course, I was struggling with that a lot. I was thinking, what if something bad happens? What if something goes wrong? And I realized, okay, I have to really pay attention. And if I need to do something, then I'll do it. And I was very lucky because it was a beautiful birth. There was no problem at all. And we were all sitting there looking at her and looking at the baby the way people have done since the beginning of time. And so it was a miracle, in not in the sense of something weird happening, but simply something happening with our full attention, something which we remembered what the animals and the beasts of the field have never forgotten. And it just completely turned me around and showed me a way that I could think about practicing that made sense. But of course, it never occurred to me that anybody else would have such a crazy idea as to want to give birth at home. So I went to New York.
What? That was me, but that was a few decades later.
So I went to New York. I was out west in Colorado at that point, and I decided I'll go to New York and see what's happening there. This was 1969. And I got a job at a big clinic, and they allowed for home visits too. And it was neat, except it was really in this very ritzy part of Brooklyn, and the clientele was from the really poor section of Brooklyn. So we had these taxis to take them from one end of the social scale to the other and back again. And they called me one day to see this old 90-year-old guy who was too sick to come into the clinic. So I go to his house, and as soon as I walk into the room, I had a sort of silvery mustache at that point. And the guy sees me, and he stands up and he salutes me. He thought I was General Pershing, his commanding officer in the First World War. And he was still a doughboy. And then he doubled over in pain. And before I'm helping him back into bed, and I feel his liver and studded with cancer nodules. And I could tell he's going to die soon. It was like a terminal case. So I told his wife, we can get him a housekeeper. And so in his last weeks and months, he'll be more comfortable. But she wouldn't hear of him dying in that wretched little apartment. So we had to admit him to the hospital. And at that point, I had to hand him over to the residents who were in training there. And I knew that they were going to want to do a liver biopsy and all kinds of chemotherapy and stuff. So I went in there to talk to them. And I said, look, you know what he has. I know what he has. Let's give him plenty of morphine and let him go. Let him die in peace. And they looked at me like I was from the Stone Age. And I knew they would. I knew that was going to be their reaction. But anyway, it was my wake-up call that practicing in New York wasn't going to work for me. So I moved back to Colorado. And I got myself a cabin in the mountains outside of Boulder. And before I knew it, people heard that I was willing to do home births, and I was suddenly getting inundated with calls after calls. I didn't even have an office. I just had a telephone. If you found me, you could have me, kind of thing. So people had to make it their business to know where I was all the time. And the truth is, I never missed a birth in those days. It was maybe 150 births in the three and a half years that I lived in Colorado at that point. I never missed a birth. I never had to take anybody to the hospital. I never had a death. I was like in a state of grace or something. I can't explain it. Because later on, when I moved to Santa Fe and then to Boston, and I opened up an office and I had a nurse and everything, I had an office practice, and then I started getting into trouble like everybody else sometimes. But the home birth really taught me how to be a doctor. In some ways, it was the best work that I've ever done. It was something that I'm still really proud of, because I wasn't getting any help from the medical society, from the doctors in town. They thought I was wacko, and which continued once I got into homeopathy. Of course, it was even worse.
Because of that saying.
I'll get there. So I just started helping people give birth at home. And then I would see them on the side for whatever ailments they had and just do a general practice. And then I moved to Santa Fe in about 3 years to study acupuncture. There was a Japanese master there that I had met, and I went there to study with him. And that was really my introduction to energy medicine. And it was a big influence on me because it was helping me do what I was already trying to do. I was already seeing the patient, making the diagnosis, and then just putting it aside, trying to go somewhere with the individuality of that patient to try to figure out a healing path for them. But I didn't know how to do it. I didn't have a method for that. But it was clean. It was good. And here was a whole philosophy that appealed to me because each patient was unique. They had, you do the pulse diagnosis, there are like 18 different readings for each time you see a patient. It requires an incredible amount of skill because you have three positions on each wrist, three depths on each wrist at each position. So that's three times three times two to the other side. So that's 18 positions. And then based on that, that tells you, using the meridians, the longitudinal energy currents, which points you want to put the needle in. Or they use also moxibustion, which is nice. But I didn't, basically, I felt like for me to really master this, I'm going to have to learn Japanese. And I'm going to have to, and also I didn't like the idea of seeing patients three and four times a week. I just didn't like to do that. And the guy was a beautiful healer, but he was very authoritarian. He was like a samurai. He was great, but
great samurai face.
it just wasn't my style. I loved those movies, but it wasn't quite right. But I opened up an office in Santa Fe and I started delivering babies and doing my general practice thing. I had tagged along with this healer, this woman healer in Boulder. She was dowsing with a pendulum and one of the things she was dowsing for was homeopathic remedies. So her shop, she had a health food store in town, and that was the first place I actually saw anybody use homeopathy. I had no idea what it was about, but I found an old copy of Neepy and Stoneham in a used bookstore. It's an old British Materia Medica.
I've heard of that one. What did you say it was called?
Neepy and Stoneham.
Okay. I don't think I've ever heard of that one.
From the 30s and 40s.
Okay.
But I couldn't make heads or tails out of it. I didn't know what was going on. But I had a patient who was really sensitive to bee stings. And I thought maybe I could give her Apis. That was about the extent of my knowledge at that time. And I got the name of an old homeopath in Vermont, and I called him up and I asked him if that would be an appropriate prescription. And he said, "Sonny boy, I think you ought to come to our summer school." So I did. And from the minute I walked into that class, I knew this is for me, because it was telling me how to do what I was already doing. I was making the diagnosis and then putting it on the shelf and trying to sit there with that patient. Mm-hmm. And this was telling me how to do that. So it was, I just loved it right away. It turned out that my first patient was myself. I went back to Santa Fe, and I had this old 48 Plymouth at the time, which is like a real clunker of a car, the huge front end and everything. And I'm driving up to see a friend, and all of a sudden this guy pulls out into my lane and hits me head on at 50 miles an hour. And I thought, I'm dead. I'm out of here. I didn't even have time to be afraid. It was just like that. And I had a concussion. I woke up, and there was the guy standing in front of me about 50 yards away, obviously drunk. And I was furious. I wanted to strangle the guy. I got out of the car. I realized I'm all busted up, because I'd broken a couple of ribs. So the ambulance comes and puts me in the front seat, and I feel sort of okay. But then when I get to the hospital, he puts me on a gurney, and if I just move a little bit to either side, I get this tremendous pain. So I call my nurse and ask her to bring the kit of remedies that I had. She gets there, and I put some Arnica 200 on my tongue. And within a couple of seconds, I was able to take my shirt off, which was an unbelievable experience. And then I was fine after that. So I started using remedies immediately, just for the usual colds and flus and acute illnesses that every GP is constantly doing. I had this lady who had a breast infection. And I had just met her. I hadn't done the birth. She had delivered in the hospital, but she'd heard of me, and she had a high fever, and she was in a lot of pain. She couldn't nurse. So she asked if I would come to her house, which I did. So I see her, and I'm rummaging around in the books trying to figure out what to give her. Bryonia was the one that seemed like the best. So I gave her some Bryonia 200 and a little packet of that. I gave her one dose and then to take some more in the course of the night. So then I get ready to leave, and she begs me to stay the night because she'd never used remedies before and she had no faith in them. So I stayed the night. And when I woke up in the morning and I went in to see her, the pain had completely disappeared. There was no fever, no nothing. Oh, it wasn't a 200. It was a 6X. I think that's all I had. I think that's all I had in my bag at the time. Goodness. So that was, and I just began to see all kinds of different stuff at births, and also just regular general practice, flus, colds, bronchitis, whatever. And it worked. It didn't work all the time. I wasn't that good at it. But it worked well enough that it sustained me in practice. Nice. And so I kept taking courses. I went back and took the course again the following year. And I went to Greece in 76. That was 2 years later, and studied with Vithulkas a little bit. And there was a Liga meeting of physicians in Athens at the same time. So I went to that first, and then I stayed on with him afterwards.
That's very interesting. And he turned 90 this year, I believe.
Something like that.
George Vithulkas, yeah. He's still going strong.
Definitely up there.
It's amazing.
But it was, what was really inspiring about him was not so much the doctrine, the actual methodology that he was teaching, but just his example was totally inspiring. That here was a person who was doing nothing but homeopathy, and was getting terrific results and also teaching all these Greek doctors. So it was, and there were a number of other Americans there with me. It was maybe, I don't know, 20, 25 other doctors were there. So it was really an inspiring event. And I just loved the homeopathy. I loved everything about it. It was just like a charm. Santa Fe was that sort of place too at that time. It just opened its arms to me. I felt like what I was doing was accepted there. I was accepted onto the medical staff of the hospital. I hardly ever went there, except occasionally when somebody would have a difficult labor, I would have to admit them to the hospital, and the OBs wouldn't let me deliver in the hospital. They passed the rule that you had to have at least 6 months residency just so that I wouldn't be allowed to deliver there. And it was more of a competition thing. It's a small town, and I was taking away from their scene. So they were just letting me know that I couldn't play ball with them. I had a couple of serious complications where they really saved my butt, and the woman's butt too.
That's why it doesn't have to be all or nothing. It can work together so beautifully.
It made me realize that my enthusiasm for home birth and for homeopathy made me make light of these complications that I really had no business making light of. I was a little bit irresponsible about that. Sometimes the remedies work beautifully. I had one lady who came in, she didn't want a home birth. She was bleeding, and she was like 6 months pregnant, and she was bleeding quite a bit. And so I was worried. There are life-threatening complications that come up sometimes. Mm. So I sent her to the hospital for an ultrasound, and I gave her some Sabina, and 200 of Sabina. And she called me the next day. She said it was indeed the placenta previa. That was the reason that I had sent her to the hospital. And the medicine worked perfectly. She miscarried during the night perfectly normally, no problem at all. She was really relieved, and so was I. But I almost lost the mother once. It's another bleed. It was because the placenta was attached really tight to the uterus in an abnormal way. It's very rare. I waited for an hour or more, and there was no urge to expel the placenta, no nothing. So I felt like I had to remove it manually. And that precipitated a hemorrhage, and it also precipitated turning the uterus inside out, that's the complication. Mm. It's called the complete inversion of the uterus. Mm. So I put her into the car and put her on oxygen, and we drove to the hospital as fast as I dared. And it was about 20 miles away. By the time we got there, her blood pressure was 0/0. She had no blood pressure at all. Mm. She was in shock. She could easily have died. Mm. And so the first OB I could find, I grabbed him and he's treating it very contemptuously, like, oh, it's another home birth. What do you expect? And so he's typing and cross-matching for blood transfusion. And I'm saying, no, this is an emergency. You really, this is. So anyway, another OB came by, and he recognized it immediately. Mm. And he took his fist, and he slammed it up into her as far as hard as he could. Mm. She woke up like that.
Wow.
Her blood pressure was 130/70. She was totally fine. And the baby I had left in the house with the nurse, the baby was perfectly okay. So
I think these things happen, and that is really terrible, but that is it's so rare for something like that to happen. And my problem with the medical model is they make as if everything is a medical emergency, but 95% of women are going to have a safe, normal pregnancy and birth. And it's when routine procedures get applied to everyone across the bank, that's when I really get my back up, because I'm the first that always say I had a ruptured appendix last year and I left it too long because I actually had the 100th celebration of our podcast. Oh no, that wasn't the podcast party. That was, we were launching my online video. And so we had a party that day. So I went with my ruptured appendix to my own party because there's no way I was going to miss that. And then the next morning I was actually interviewing Dana Ullman and it took me so long to get him on the show. So with my ruptured, I was like, there's no way I'm going to hospital. I have to do this interview first. Straight after the interview, we went to hospital and I left it too long. And so the operation ended up being much worse than what it had to be. I ended up being in hospital a lot longer than I had to be. But thank God for the medical profession. And we can work so beautifully together, but that's an incredible story. And just as easily, that could have been missed in hospital if that experience, OB, sure, hadn't been there to do the procedure that he did. Even though she was in a hospital, they might have lost her anyway.
He had seen one case in his entire career during his residency, so he knew what it was immediately. And I learned the lesson really well because the woman never paid me, which I could really understand. So I had to eat that.
It's an interesting one, though, and that's, don't get me started on that, because the reality is if she had gone to with a private OB or whatever and that had happened, she would have had to pay them anyway. And that's something I often see. In our profession, for some reason, people think sometimes it's okay to not pay us or whatever, but they will, that same person will go back to the same doctor over and over and over, get no results, and probably end up getting poisoned from drugs, but they will pay all of those bills.
Yeah.
But no, I get you. I think us homeopaths are a bit too nice. Richard, so can anyway, I just say, you are an exceptional storyteller, exceptional. It's incredible listening. It's incredible listening to you.
Some amazing stories.
Yeah. And I've got your pregnancy and childcare book that I've had on my desk. It was one of the first ones I got. I once, while I was still studying it over a decade ago, a homeopath retired and I bought her boxes of books. I think it was like $250 and I got boxes and boxes of books. And I think your book was in there as well, because I just remember I got all these books that were just incredible and which I was so grateful for. But you had a 5-decade career. You've written several books. And I hear you would think that right now you'd be sitting back, feet up, just having a nice, relaxing time. But I hear you are writing another book. Are you mad?
I really wanted to look back on it as a whole.
Well, I mean, I'm so grateful you did.
A lot of the stuff that's in there, I've already written about, but it's put together in a different way. So once I get past the early years, the ones I've just been describing, then there's 3 long essays, which are about the 3 topics that have been exercising me for all these years as a result of all of these questions and doubts and problems that I was having. So the first section is, of course, homeopathy. So there's 2 chapters on homeopathy. And what I really emphasized is not so much how to do it. I wasn't trying to do that, but to differentiate it from the medical system, to show how different this is. Because I was really using my philosophy there. And really, I think that's what the book basically is. It's the philosophy of medicine. And homeopathy is just a perfect exemplar of that. And then the next section is the medical system itself, how I see that, why I have a problem with it, why I think we all have a problem with it, even though we don't necessarily know it or realize it. And I go back to my favorite painting it's a Rembrandt from the 17th century. It shows this doctor dissecting a human body, a cadaver, just like we did in med school, the very first thing. And he exposes the forearm of the cadaver. So he has his clamp on the flexor tendon, and the students are like, whoa! And he's about to pull on the clamp, and so the fingers are going to go like this. It's the theory, it's causality is what it's about. And it's the radical discovery of mechanical causality that happened really during the Renaissance when Michelangelo and Leonardo were stealing bodies in order to dissect them and for their art. But they got the idea. And it's still the way we practice. It's that same concept of causality is what we're after. The trouble is that the concept is too rigorous. It's much more rigorous than real life is, where the causality is much subtler usually. And we don't make room for that. We want to override that because we want to make sure that the body is going to behave the way we insist that it should behave. So we develop a technology, whether it's a surgical or a chemical, to force the body to behave the way we think it should. And so that's what that section is really about. And then the last section is about vaccination, my hobby horse of recent years. And again, that just came out of my practice. It wasn't in the beginning. It was just, I didn't like it. I didn't like the idea of it. It didn't seem like a good idea to me, but I couldn't exactly say why. It just felt, especially to try to prevent diseases that were already on the wane to begin with, like tetanus or diphtheria, or weren't that serious. Chickenpox or
measles,
rotavirus or something like that, which was pretty serious in Africa, but it's because the kids are malnourished. It's not a problem in the United States. Some kids are hospitalized with it. Anyway, I just had this baggage about it. And when I moved to Boston, I took a sabbatical. And part of what I did was I studied things that I should have learned when I was in med school, but they don't emphasize it. They don't really teach you about vaccines in any depth. And what really struck me was that the diseases that we vaccinate against are acute diseases. That is, this tremendous outpouring of the whole immune system is involved, and it's all working together in several aspects. And the result of all of that outpouring is that the virus or the bacterium is expelled from the body. And so that if it comes back again, it's encrypted in the memory of the immune competent cells. So it's not going to happen. Whereas vaccination is a chronic phenomenon. It's not acute. It's designed to prevent something that may possibly happen years in the future. So you're using a chronic phenomenon. And that bothered me. That just felt weird to me. But it was really my experience with children that showed me how correct that was, because basically the first thing, there were too many vaccines given and they were at too short intervals to be able to tell that this particular disease came from this particular vaccine. Although I did a little bit of that in the beginning, where the kids would manifest signs and symptoms that were similar to the disease that was being vaccinated against. But they were minor illnesses. And the main thing that I started noticing, and this was like in the late 80s, after I'd already been in Boston for a few years, that after they were vaccinated, the kids were more vulnerable to whatever acute diseases were going around town. They would pick them up in school and so forth. Or it would make worse whatever chronic diseases they already had. And the one that really struck me a lot because it was so common was chronic ear infections, because that was like ubiquitous at that time. So I started seeing many cases of that. The first one seemed like it was from the MMR vaccine. And so I thought, maybe it's a specific, doctors are trained to look for specific symptoms from specific drugs. So that was an important part of our training. So the idea that there would be non-specific responses to vaccines, like making them more susceptible to what was going around town or a worse version of whatever disease they already had, nobody thinks like that, including me. So it took me a while to realize that's what was happening. So at first I thought maybe it's the MMR, but then I started having cases where it was the DPT. And pretty soon it started to dawn on me that, like, there was this one woman who had exactly the same reaction to two different vaccines. No matter which vaccine she was given, the kid always reacted the same way. It was her reaction. It was specific to her. And of course, that, even if the doctors were aware of it, that enabled them to say, she's just hypersensitive. It's a genetic thing, something. So it took a while. But after a while, it became really clear that at the very least, if a kid, the problem was the kid had to get better for a while, because when you have a chronic disease, it has ups and downs, and it's hard to tell that it was specific, that it was vaccine related, because there were these ups and downs. And so I found that I would treat, like, this one kid. I treated her with remedies and she got better and it was beautiful. And then this lasted for 5 or 6 months. Then they separated, the couple separated, and the dad wanted to take her for the MR at 16 months. And so he did, and the kid, and it just brought it right back, and like gangbusters. So whereas the first time she reacted to the DPT, this time she reacted to the MMR. So that told me that this was a generic thing. This was something about the vaccination process per se. And so then I started seeing other diseases as well, like asthma or bronchitis or you name it. Or
were you seeing much delayed development and, like, autistic type traits back then?
Tons of that. Tons
children
of that.
Who had speech and then they lose that speech, or had eye contact and they lose eye contact.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. In fact, I wrote up a case. It's not in the book, but I did publish it, about an autistic kid who, again, you know, just because they react manifestly to one or the other vaccines, the others are also acting. It's just that you don't see it directly. It's subclinical for a while before it manifests. But here's the clearest example I can give you from my practice. It was a girl that I had treated all through elementary school, where she was bedwetting and she had OCD, really obsessive compulsive stuff. And I gave her a number of remedies. Arsenicum was the one that helped her the most, and she was fine. She was essentially symptom free for about 10 years. And then she goes off to college, and the college insists that she get an MMR booster. And within a week, the whole thing came back just the way it used to be, exactly the same. And again, the Arsenicum album worked like a charm. So if you just put any other disease in that place, and if the kid gets better for, say, 4 to 6 months, then when the next vaccine comes down the pike, there's no question in the parent's mind or in your mind, or even in the pediatrician's mind, if they allow themselves to see it, because it's obvious, usually very quickly. Within a week or so, it'll come right back. Maybe even worse than it was before. That was the train of thought that really got me going. So then I started combing through the literature, and I started finding a lot of stuff that nobody reads. Nobody pays attention to it, but it was along very much the same lines, that they took developed countries, and they studied the just how many times they went to the doctor, how many times they were hospitalized, how many times they died. Mm-hmm. Specifically, the infant mortality was what they were interested in, the deaths in the first year, because that's an important public health measure of the general health of the population. And they found that the infant mortality rate was directly proportional to the number of vaccines that were given in the first year. So they divided the countries into five groups who had a small number of vaccines, a slightly larger, and the largest. And we were, of course, in the largest group. In fact, we were the largest single country, and our infant mortality was almost three times that of the countries at the lower end, like Sweden, Japan. But again, it's a statistical study. Those kinds of studies are considered not equivalent to proof. They're suggested.
I don't know how much proof people want.
Exactly. It was, and there were several other studies along the same lines. The same authors did another study, and they found out that if you give a number of vaccines simultaneously at the same visit, again, there's a proportionality between the number of visits to the emergency room, the number of deaths, depending on whether there are, say, two vaccines given or four or six. It's just a direct proportion. So in other words, it's something about the vaccination process per se, and therefore the number, the absolute number that you get is the crucial ingredient of risk. So there again, it was saying the same thing in different words.
I recently had an adult client, she's in her 40s, and she sent me her childhood vaccination schedule. And it was really interesting because on the government's, you know, schedule that she printed out or she got from her baby book or whatever, it actually said, instead of saying DTP, it actually said diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, and then diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus. So it was all, had them all laid out. So it actually looked quite terrifying when you see how many she's had. And I'm 44. We had much less in those days, but to see them all singled out like that was actually quite mind blowing. And I think what happens these days is you get your baby report and it says infant rex hexa, which is actually six diseases, and Prevnar and rotavirus. And that's what the children here in Australia get at 2, 4, and 6 months. But if you were to actually write out those six diseases and the rotavirus and Prevnar, so say at 2 months, you wrote that they've been vaccinated for eight diseases. And then 2 months later, you go back another eight, 2 months later, another eight. I think if people actually visually saw all that, they would click, but they don't. They see two needles go in and a drop on the tongue, and they think it's not that bad. But actually, if you were to break it all up, it's pretty shocking.
A lot of parents were nervous. They felt that they were getting too many. And it was just, again, it was just an intuitive feeling. It wasn't necessarily that something definite had happened that they could pin down. It was just a gut feeling.
I think so. Anyway, listen to those gut feelings. The world wouldn't be in the state that it is. I think, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on the COVID vaccinations, because I think the whole COVID dilemma could have been avoided if we actually listened to our instincts, because people were doing things that they would never normally do if they were actually in a, just thinking rationally. We were all going, not all of us, because I wasn't wearing masks or did not get the vaccine. So most people were going against their intuition. It didn't feel right to not have family members over for Christmas because they weren't vaccinated, but somehow people would do it anyway. It didn't feel right to put a mask on a child, but people were still doing it anyway. And I think that's my thing over and over, is trying to get people back to listening to that intuition. It's still there. It's a tiny little voice that never leaves you, but it's just so drowned out by the constant propaganda around us.
I mean, I guess just cutting to the chase, it was clear that something fishy was happening, because people have been monkeying around with coronaviruses for a long time, since the SARS in 2002. And biolabs in the United States and all over the world were doing gain-of-function research with these viruses, with coronaviruses, and trying, like when SARS happened and also MERS, they tried to develop vaccines against it. And they found that it was really dangerous because they were getting cytokine storm was happening, this hyperimmune reaction, which turns out that it's like a dysregulation because the vaccine is concentrating on antibody production, which is just one part of the whole immune response. It dysregulates the rest of the response. So they were, this showed up really strongly in the dengue vaccine that they were using in the Philippines. The kids were getting tremendously high titers of vaccine, of antibodies, and everybody was thrilled and excited about that. But then when they were actually exposed to the virus, they would go completely crazy. Mm. The titers would be off the charts and the kids would die. Mm. So they had to take the drugs off the market. And when the mRNA vaccines started being developed against the COVID, even people like Paul Offit, who is a darling of the industry and never meets a vaccine he doesn't like, started saying, hey, wait a minute.
Old prophet.
Yeah. It was a little late, but, and of course, nobody paid attention to him. But.
Oh, I didn't realize that he said that. But yeah, I know the jokes go around with him being called Paul Prophet because he's such a huge advocate. I didn't know that he spoke out against the COVID vaccines.
Yeah, he did. Oh, and so did, there's another one in the same category. I'm trying to remember who it was. I can't remember who it was. Anyway, it's all in the article. Okay. But anyway, what I started to say was that scientists were really worried about leaks from the laboratory, and there actually were a couple of leaks of some influenza viruses that were that had been bioengineered, and they leaked out of the laboratory. Nobody got hurt, but they could have been. Mm. And so in 2014, President Obama declared a halt to all gain-of-function research, and everybody was relieved. As soon as Trump was elected, they reinstituted it, but not in the United States. They gave a big grant to the laboratory in Wuhan in China to continue gain-of-function research with coronaviruses.
So it wasn't the Americans that was doing it in China. It was actually the Chinese that were doing it, but they gave...
Well, yeah, exactly who was who and what was what is not entirely clear. There are a lot of efforts being made to suppress that information. And then the other strange thing that was happening was that Fauci and Dr. Fauci, the head of the division of NIH, who was later on the head of the task force against the COVID, and also Bill Gates, the multi-billionaire, who is an evangelist for vaccinating everybody against everything, Gates organized a simulated pandemic in October of 2019, just a few months before the first recorded case, which was in Wuhan, of course. And it was in a big hotel in New York. And one of the people that they invited to it was the head of the CDC of China. And to me, that sounds awfully like they already knew about it at that time. And that was 2 months before the first recorded case. So
very interesting. I always also found it interesting that Bill and Melinda Gates divorced during the whole COVID thing, and they were married for many decades. It's all very interesting. I was too busy in my clinic helping clients to really know much about what was going on worldwide. I was just head down in the trenches. Yeah.
They're still together on the foundation, however.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. All these things we could never possibly know the real story behind all of it, but it's certainly interesting to speculate.
Yeah. Anyway, it seems the agency of the NIH that Fauci is the head of was already working on a vaccine when the emergency was declared. So that says to me that they've known about this. And now it's way beyond my pay grade to mm-hmm. be able to decide whether the leak was accidental or mm-hmm. otherwise. I'll leave that to those who specialize in such things. But what is clear is that whoever was working on the coronavirus must have succeeded brilliantly in whatever it was they had in mind, because the illness that resulted is really unique. It's really different from the run-of-the-mill diseases that we vaccinate against. For example, it has a chronic aspect to it.
Yeah.
And the first thing that I noticed about it was that it was making worse the chronic diseases that were already there. The people who were dying were the people in the nursing homes who were already chronically ill. And so that rang a bell, because that was my whole vaccine work, was showing exactly that. So it was having a vaccine-like effect, which to me meant chronic. And then there's the long COVID. And then there's the cytokine storm phenomenon, which it turns out was present in all of those severe cases of ARDS, like that were dying on ventilators in the hospital in the beginning. But then it turned out that it wasn't just in the lungs, that there were these microclots in different organs all over the body. And when they did autopsies on those people, they found cytokine storm, the same hyperimmune dysregulation response. And then when they would test the long COVID, they found similar. It wasn't as severe. It wasn't as violent as cytokine storm, but it was of the same type. It was a dysregulating hyperimmune type of reaction. So to me, that's the most conclusive evidence that this was made in a laboratory, that this was not a natural. It may have originated as a bat virus, but they were monkeying around with it for sure. And again, I'm not going to comment on whether it was deliberate or not. That's a whole other ballgame. Everyone's just assuming that it was an accident. But what I do know is that they were working on something pretty important at that laboratory, whatever it was. And it's hard to, let's put it this way, if they were trying to design a stealth bioweapon to kill off people, it would have worked very well for that.
It's not funny at all, but like, I just find with everything going on in the world, I have to laugh about it, because if I didn't, I think I would have a mental breakdown, because it's really hard for me to think that humans can do these things on purpose. And the reality is that they do, and they have always done, but we just have to look at history to know what humans are capable of.
But there's a lot of other stuff too. Not only, take a look at RFK Jr.'s book about...
I haven't read it yet, but it's on my list.
He researched it very thoroughly.
Yeah, he's an amazing man.
The only trouble with the book is that it doesn't have an index. So it's a hell of a job reading it. I wrote a review of the book. I read it pretty carefully, but I had to go back and back and do it over, because I couldn't find... I had to rummage to find the references that I was looking
for. Oh, that's a shame. It was probably done in a rush to get it out there, which... sometimes getting that information out there quickly can be more important initially than taking the extra time. I mean, you've written many books. From the authors I've had on the podcast, they all say it can take years. And I've had several books that's been in my head for years. So it's probably going to be many more years before it actually comes out. I wonder if that's maybe why.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. But anyway, what I started to say is that creating and managing pandemics is just one of the futuristic things that are being messed around with, GMO agriculture and fake meat and transhumanism, for example. You know about that, where using gene splicing technology and introducing that into people so that their gene pool is itself partially synthesized, partially bioengineered. There are people actually working on this.
I did not know that. I don't know that I want to know that. I think it's going to put my head in the sand.
Exactly.
It's a scary time to be raising kids. I'm not going to lie, having an 11 and 8-year-old, I really worry about their future. But I always think as parents, the most important lesson we can teach our kids these days is distinguishing fake from fiction and trusting their intuition. Because I think if you can do that, then you stand a chance in the future. Because with AI and all of these things that our children are faced with, they're going to have to be really good at sniffing out the BS and knowing. And I think if you always trust your intuition, that can't lead you astray.
So anyway, I'm not going to go into the details about the COVID and the lying and the propaganda and the censorship. Mm. It's all there, but I just don't have time to do that, I'm afraid. Mm. But it's in the article and you can use whatever you can.
Well, I think you should publish it even as an ebook so people can purchase it online as an ebook even. Yeah. I read if it's only 70 pages, but stick it on Amazon as an ebook. We can all support your work and purchase it that way. And I'd love to have a read. Richard, where can people, when's your new book coming out and where can people buy it? And
I'm not sure. It's probably going to be another maybe month or two before it comes out.
You might have to forego the index to get it out sooner. I'm kidding.
The people at BeJane are very nice, but I don't have a lot of contact with them. But they seem very obliging. They'll do pretty much what I want.
That's brilliant. I've had them on the podcast as well. And I always buy my pillows from them. So I've had a lot to do with BeJane over the years and I found them really helpful as well.
Yeah, I've been thrilled with them actually. Because I could not find an American publisher who would touch it.
Oh wow.
It's partly I think because there are two different strands of it that are so different. There's the memoir with all these personal stories, and then there's the more didactic stuff at the end. And most people would rather do one or the other, but not both. But I needed to do both because I wanted to show where it came from.
I'm really glad you did, because that's one of the things whenever I interview people with decades of experience, I am personally very intrigued on their journey. And I think that's why I love case taking so much. It's listening to people's journey that really inspires me and where all the lessons are. And we have naturally learned from stories for millennia. That's how knowledge is passed on, is by storytelling. So that's the part that I personally find the most interesting.
I just can't resist throwing this in at the last minute.
Yeah, do it.
This is about homeopathy. It's just a little thing that I've learned. It's really not so little, that after you've treated a number of cases with the same remedy successfully, especially certain ones that are vivid, then you have an image, an archetype in your mind of what that remedy is like, that long after you forget the rubrics or all of that repertorization, except for maybe a few key symptoms that you rely on. But the image of that person, the visual image is there. And there's a couple of cases in the book that I try to illustrate that. But there was this one guy who came in and he was overweight and very loud and boisterous, and he was a very successful businessman, and he talked in a loud voice, and I immediately wrote sulfur in the margin. I didn't want to dwell on it. I just wanted to record that image was there. And so then I took the case and I repertorized it and everything else, and it was beautiful sulfur. And it worked like a charm. And so it's something that we're not always aware of, but it's there. Mm. And I presented another case of agaricus like that, where it's a lesser known remedy, but there's a certain lore about the remedy that it's been used in various civilizations for. Like the warriors would take it the night before the battle to have courage and so on. And it's known in the Materia Medicus for its boastfulness. So I just had a patient, and that was just hitting me in the face. And I presented it as seductive, something that can easily lead even an experienced prescriber to just prescribe it without doing the work of repertorizing and confirming it. So it also becomes an occupational hazard. But
it's a double-edged sword, that one. It really is. Yeah, so, because I think as long as we're always the unbiased observer and we have these remedies coming and going through our mind, right. But what's happening these days, and I'm very wary of your time, it's getting later on in the evening there, but I am really enjoying that there's this new kind of wing of homeopathy, which is to do with intuitive prescribing. And that can go both ways, but I think intuition automatically comes with years of experience. So it feels like it's intuition, but it's actually just many years of practice, reading Materia right. Medica, reading cases, what you prescribe. And then you start seeing a pattern where you end up prescribing what was intuitively in your mind as the person walked in and you felt their energy. So it feels like intuition, but it's not just that. It's actually art and science and lots of hard work all combined.
The remedy Simasifiga is maybe my favorite remedy of all time, because that I would say that's my one original Materia Medica contribution is from that remedy, because I used it a lot in the births and in the patients who were of that age group who were getting pregnant or who had been pregnant. And it's really a doozy.
I have to ask you, how often in Simasifiga have you seen fear of rats? Because I sometimes ask my clients and
I've never seen it.
No, I know. It's in there. And I'm like, I have never seen fear of rats in any of those. And I've got a couple of other, which seems to be like a big thing in the case, but I've just never had it verified. So I've just thrown it out the window now.
The first thing that I picked up from the literature about it that was that it was pessimistic, that it was
dark cloud sitting over them is one of the
negative. Yeah. So I had a woman who was sailing through her labor. She was doing great, but she always had this in the back of her mind that she couldn't do it, that it was she wasn't going to be able to carry it through. And so the head was halfway down the vagina and suddenly her labor just completely stopped. And so I gave her, just on the strength of that, I gave her a hit of Simasifiga and it just came right out immediately. But that was just the surface. The deeper stuff is basically a fear of insanity. Mm-hmm. And the fear is reasonable because it's happening. Mm-hmm. It's more than a fear. I had this woman who she got to 42 weeks. Nothing doing. So I had her in the office and she finally told me that she had an abortion just before this pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And it was terribly painful. So mm-hmm. she was dreading the birth because she figured it would be even worse. Mm-hmm. And so then about a week later, she goes into labor. I get to her house and she's psychotic. She's mm-hmm. like completely out to lunch. And the character of that was like, it's like there's a glue that holds our experiences together and makes them ours so that there's a continuity of self. She didn't have that the experiences were disarticulated. They didn't make a whole. They were just chunks. And the physical symptoms of that remedy are like that too. So it's just so weird. And so there's a whole thing about that in the book. Because I contrasted it with colophyllum, the other remedy for difficult labor. There are many remedies for difficult labor, but those two are always compared because they, in the provings, they have the ability to produce these abnormal contractions that simulate those of dysfunctional labor. So
Camilla Scher says Simasifuga is good for your aphids on your roses as well. So you can use it for that too. So, Richard, once this, where can we find out when the book comes out? Do we just need to keep an eye on the Bea Jane website, or where would be a good place for
us? I guess so. I'll post it on Facebook as soon as it comes out. And I'll be glad to send you an announcement of it.
That'll be wonderful. And I'll post it in my Homeopathy Hangout podcast Facebook group. Great. Do you have a website or newsletter, or is what getting you on Facebook just the best way to?
Just on Facebook. I used to have a website when I was practicing, but I stopped it. I'm sorry that I did, because I'd like to do a blog maybe, but I have no clue how to do it. So I guess it goes through a website in some way.
I can hook you up with all that. We'll get you sorted. I'll give you details afterwards, but it's actually pretty easy.
Okay, cool.
It was incredible experience speaking with you today, Richard. Thank you so much for your time. I cannot wait to read your book. I'm so excited.
I love meeting you, Jenny. I love your spirit.
Oh, thank you so much, Richard. And thank you I always feel like us younger homeopaths, we're standing on the shoulders of giants. It's people like you and all these other homeopaths that have just laid your decades of work. You've given us such a solid foundation to work on. When we're helping our pregnant woman, or when we're starting to question vaccines, we don't have to go through all that hard work. You've handed it to us on a platter in all your beautiful work. So thank you so much for all of that.
Welcome.
Thank you so much, Richard. All the best.
Great to meet you.